Welcome to Bounce Back. My name's Yvonne Fletcher from NY Events, and you're listening in on DRN1. Bounce Back is a fun talk back show. And today we have Nicholas Manise, or Nick Manise, sorry, Nick. We just
That's
talked
fine.
about that.
We did literally just discuss how you want to introduce me, and you've. That's fine, no worries.
I got his birth name instead. Sorry, Nick. So Nick is actually with me today, and he's in London. So back in lockdown, Nick. How you going?
Yeah. It's not as bad as everyone, as it might seem. I think the first lockdown was particularly brutal. I mean, I think you guys got off pretty easy in WA.
Oh, very,
just speaking to my family and stuff like that. But I mean, the first lockdown was particularly brutal, just in terms of no businesses were prepared for how they were, you know, how to cope with this government order to basically, you know, not allow any people anywhere near other people. So this time around, I think everyone's sort of a little bit more organized, so everyone was ready almost to switch on to takeaway business. So as long as I can sort of, you can still get coffee takeaway or get, you know, food takeaway, it kind of does ease the blow. But it's not fun. It's been a very long year. We've had some form of like lockdown for 9 months or so yes, kind of brutal. But
Yeah. I think, did you seriously literally just leave Perth Fringe at the beginning of this year and head back into a lockdown situation?
Yeah, I think I had about 3 weeks. And it was kind of funny. You could just sort of feel it getting closer because you could kind of track the virus's movement through Europe. And we were, I think, sort of at the time, we were probably like, you know, 3 or 4 weeks behind Milan, and then another week or two behind France and Paris. So as soon as sort of Paris went into lockdown, we were like, oh, right, okay, we've got probably about a week, and then we're also going to be shut down. Basically from March until I want to say like May or June, it was pretty quiet in the city, and then things have sort of opened up. And even though we've gone into, like I said, this second lockdown, I think everyone's a little bit more prepared to handle it. And everyone's sort of got those processes in place to let life kind of keep going. And we've been lucky. We've had a kind of mild weather, so you can still kind of stay outside and it's bearable. If it's like this, probably in another month, it's going to be pretty, pretty bad, but hey.
Yeah, it'll be hitting your winter then, won't it? So
Yeah. So yeah, wow. But it is what it is, you know? Just it's like no point in like over thinking it. So yeah, it's fine.
I was with you. We did have a lot of great takeaway services here. I think I started living on more takeaway than ever for some reason. and coffee. That became my, you know, well, I do get coffee a day, but I was very grateful that I could still access that because I did it on my own.
it's one of those ones as well where being able to go out and also just speak to someone, even if it is the barista or the guy at the kebab shop, just to actually have a chat with someone outside of, like, I mean, because everyone was stuck in their home, so it's just me and my girlfriend, and we've just got like a pretty tiny flat in London, as is probably standard. So to be able to go out and talk to someone else, I think was really, it's like refreshing. It's quite important just for your sanity too. So yeah, with you on that one. Essential.
No, it's very true. And Nick, how did you start out in comedy?
Good gear change. I think if we want to like go back to the very start, I sort of always, you know, we'll go even further. I guess in high school, I used to watch, I'd come home and watch a lot of stand-up on YouTube after school. Like, I would just come home, and this is like the days of family computers before laptops. I'd just like sit in our family room and sort of just put in headphones and watch stand-up comedy for hours, which used to absolutely drive my family nuts because they had no context to what I was laughing about because I had the headphones in, so I'd just be sitting there cackling. And I think I probably didn't realize that at the time, but it was probably like a little bit of a precursor to where I would ultimately end up. I think in maybe first or second year uni, so it's probably about 18 or 19, I did a one stand-up set at a charity fundraiser for the surf club I was at. And that was, I think, probably pretty appalling. There's no like footage or recording of it. I didn't really know what I was doing. I guess I and probably a bit similar. I mean, you sort of had Matt Storer on the other week and I listened to that, but probably a little bit similar to that. I kind of didn't really know about the stand-up scene or that there were really sort of stand-up clubs. So I had no context. I just was sort of like, oh yeah, I'll do it for the fundraiser. I'll do a tight five, in reality what was probably a very sloppy and loose 3 minutes or something like that. So I did that, and then sort of started going to comedy clubs. I'd go to Lazy Susan's and Shapiro Tuesdays, which was a room in Perth. And then I studied in the US and sort of would go to the comedy nights that the university I was at put on, and I'd go and just sort of watch. Sorry, and this is very long-winded. Then I came, obviously, back to Perth and started doing speeches at Mates 21sts. And was just like, absolutely, if I'm perfectly honest, just absolutely crushing. You know, I remember a friend of mine who was particularly boring, love him, but, and I won't drop his name, but, I gave a speech that just made him seem like the funniest, most hilarious person out there. And I was like, oh, I'm actually quite good at this and quite good at sort of controlling a room. And then it probably took me about 2 years of writing to actually build up the courage to do a set. And I eventually did that and did my, I used to write on my lunch break and sort of write and scribble jokes on my lunch break. And that's not every day for 2 years, but it's sort of like little bits and pieces every now and again. And then I booked my first gig in that month. Before that gig, I just wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. And I thought I had so much content, and I did the gig. Did I think pretty decently for a first timer, but very quickly realized that it's that content is not good enough. It's going to need a lot more work. But I guess that was my long-winded start in doing it. And then I just sort of basically eventually ended up doing as many gigs as I can. Sometimes going up to like 5, 6, 7 a week in Perth. There was a time where there was lots happening, and I was gigging a lot in those early days. And went from there.
How long have you been doing it for then?
So I just looked at my calendar earlier. So I'm actually 5 years, but I'll be honest, the last two have been pretty quiet. Like if you were to look at my split of gigs, I'd say like sort of 80% of them happened in those first 3 years. And then I moved to London 2 years ago now, and sort of had a bit of a career change, moving into something where I guess it's more aligned with my interest in stand-up and talking to people and communicating with people, because that for me is a big part of it. It is having that connection and having discussions. I sort of, maybe partly out of laziness, partly because I quite enjoy it, I do work in a decent amount of crowd work. It's mostly me panicking and attacking people. But I sort of worked that into my sets, and I guess I wanted to transition to that. So I do a fair bit of radio myself. I switched from working as a landscape architect to working as a journalist, and that was incredibly time consuming. And then I also probably didn't factor in how difficult it can be to move countries. So that sort of first year here in London, I was still gigging, but probably only once every couple of weeks, as opposed to, you know, between 3 and 5 and sometimes 7 nights a week. Maybe not 7, but 3 and 5 nights a week. So that was quite a big shift. And then obviously this year I did sort of Perth Fringe, and this was going to be my year to really attack the London scene. But basically, as we discussed at the start, the whole country's been in lockdown. So we sort of came out of a lockdown early, maybe in August, and I think like a phase of the lockdown was still, obviously plenty was still restricted, and I got one gig in September, and then I had a heap booked for November, and obviously we went into a second intense lockdown, so they all got cancelled. So who knows what's going to happen, who knows when I'll be back on stage. But now it's 2021, I'll really have a red hot crack at the UK scene.
Yeah, that'd be great. Bring on 2021. Nick, what inspired you to get into comedy, or is there a person that you inspires you in comedy at all, like in the scene now or internationally?
Yeah, I mean, I think I inspired myself. No, those 21st speeches, that was what really sort of kicked it over. Because and in a way, it was sort of a little bit like a stand-up set. I probably had like 80 people in it, and yeah, like I said, there was like it was quite thrilling to just control the room, control the tempo, and you know, obviously make 80 people laugh. And it, I mean, that's significantly easier given you all know this one person and it's built around this one subject. But then I guess leading up to, or in that sort of first year of doing comedy, which must have been 20, hang on, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, yeah, 2016. It was sort of, I used to listen to this podcast, Comedians, Comedian podcast. And this British guy whose name is now escaping me. I sort of haven't listened to the podcast for ages, but he basically would interview comedians from across the globe and have really sort of intimate discussions with them, probably kind of similar to this. And I used to seek out all the Australian comics. And I always really liked Tom Gleeson, and his Comedians podcast was just sort of outstanding. And that sort of did influence my approach, I guess, to comedy in that just him talking about his confidence and like how funny it would be if you were just confident, which I guess I'm not necessarily on. Like I think there's a confidence to who I am on stage, but it's there's is I think perhaps a confidence built in the fact that I actually really don't know what I'm doing and this whole thing's maybe a little bit of a little bit of a bluff. So I mean, sorry.
You pull it off well.
Oh, thank you, thank you. I think yeah. So if there was a comedian in the Australian scene, it probably would be Tom Gleeson. I hosted a gig with him earlier this year actually. Fuck, I sucked. It was one of those ones. No, it was one of those ones. I don't know why I was. Oh, I know why I was so nervous. But it just led to this like really sort of mediocre performance, and I'm sure no one else felt it. But it's one of those ones where it's like, yeah, I was a bit
Oh,
rubbish. But
because I was going
that's
to
right.
ask you, what was your biggest learning curve or bomb on stage? So would that be right up there with a bomb or not really, or a
Yeah,
learning curve?
probably. I mean, I think it's one of those ones where I didn't bomb for a long while. You know, I wasn't good, but I certainly didn't have what you describe as a bomb for a long time early on when I started. And I remember when I did have my first one. You know, I it was this gong night at the National. And I was so stressed out, and gong nights still stress me out. I just, I, yeah, I just hate them, but I'll still do them. But you know, I just hate the fact that power's in someone in the hands of, you know, maybe three people that who the rest of the room might be enjoying you, and they don't, and then you get gonged off.
Hey, they might be on their own little rush, hey?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think that's what happened. And I probably didn't, this was this first bomb probably back in 2016 at the National, which was a gong night in Fremantle. And I didn't come on stage with any particular confidence because I think I was so stressed about this. And within about 20 seconds, two paddles, people had their paddles up. So you need three paddles to get gonged off. And then I told my first joke and the third paddle went up and I was off.
Oh, no.
But I've heard people get gonged off without even telling a joke. So really not that bad.
That's so rough.
But I think, yeah, I think that I don't know if that was a particular learning curve, but it maybe is as charted, you know, something that I think is relevant for every sort of comedian, even if you play perhaps a low status, if you have a low status presence on stage. I think there still needs to be an element of confidence in you as a performer on stage. I mean, I think the audience needs to be able to trust you, and the only way they can trust you is if they feel that there's some sort of confidence coming from you. And I think that's probably the biggest thing that I still do struggle with. It's a sense of maybe, you know, do I belong at a certain gig that I'm at? And that does come across in your confidence on stage.
I think you're right in some ways. I think if you're nervous, the audience picks up on that nerves and they become nervous, don't they?
Oh, 100%. I think there's an analogy. I can't remember where I heard it, but it's a little bit like, I'm going to absolutely butcher this, but it's like it's a little bit like flying a plane. Like if the pilot came on over the PA and was like, "Well, I'm going to have a red hot crack at landing on this runway, but we'll just sort of see how we go." People are going to be freaking out because the person that's in control clearly isn't in control. And I think the same thing sort of happens with stand-up, where it's like you are the person in control of that room, and if they can feel that you're not in control, I mean, they wouldn't be freaking out like a plane was crashing, but they're not going to certainly respect you or you know, behave themselves and go along with whatever you're serving up.
I love that analogy, like your comedy is like a plane crashing. That not yours personally, but you know, if you keep bombing,
sort of how that sounded,
that's kind of scary.
Yeah, so I think it's one of those ones. But equally, I mean, the rush you get from it, half the time I don't even really know what I've done or said on stage. It is still like an absolute rush, a little bit of, I almost black out. It's one of those ones. Maybe it's a little bit more like skydiving. It happens so quickly and I kind of don't really know what's going on.
Yeah, I like that you get that natural high from it then as well. So that's...
Yeah, definitely.
That's cool. That's a buzz thing. How have you developed your career then? Like you said that you went to America and you were studying, and obviously that was in a different field to comedy, but you were doing comedy there as well?
No, sorry. I should have made that clear. That was in the build up to starting comedy. I watch a lot of comedy in the United States, but I've gigged in the States several times. I sort of used to do this thing where I would, anytime I went on holiday, I'd sort of book a gig in whatever country I was in. So I think I've gigged in Thailand, Vietnam, United States. Surely there's a few others in Southeast Asia. Anyway, it does it. Yeah, basically anytime I go on holiday, I book a gig. But how I guess have I developed? I mean, I think for me, it's sort of trying to work out where I fit, and I think trying to stand out maybe is it can be particularly challenging. I mean, I sort of, my approach to I guess developing my career was to sort of combine the things that I'm interested in. And I think for me, that started with combining, I guess, like by trade, I'm a landscape architect and an urban designer, and that's what I write about as well. So I switched to writing about that and talking about it and podcasting about it, which has been absolutely amazing. Like the architects I get to speak to and landscape architects I get to speak to through the work I'm currently doing is just absolutely phenomenal. You know, I get quite nervous. Some of the people I get to speak to is really, really exciting, inspiring. Probably how you're feeling right now, Yvonne. But I think
unique.
I was sort of trying to work out where maybe it's not career progression so much, but I think I'm working this out on the fly. I think maybe if we go back to the very start, I sort of made, you know, the two Raw Comedy state finals straight off the bat, which at the time feels like a big deal. And you sort of get out afterwards and you realize that it doesn't really matter what happens there. It is just exciting to be in it and to be, I guess, sort of recognized by your peers and whoever's judging as being up and coming. But really you realize it's nothing. And maybe they're some of my biggest bombs, in fact. Both my state finals were pretty average, despite, you know, I think actually, yeah, ripping through the semis. I sort of always struggled with that sort of pressure I've put on myself, whenever I get to that. And I'm not saying that I would have won, just to be clear. But I mean, to show you that it probably doesn't matter, I couldn't even tell you off the top of my head who won the second year I went. I know Squarely won in that first year I was in it. Sorry, but that aside, I think it did sort of feed into my what I wanted to do in terms of comedy, and I realized very quickly that things would be beyond my control, and I might not be able to necessarily, you know, there are people that are gatekeepers and they might not necessarily like what I'm doing, and that's perfectly fine. So I need to sort of find a way to control it myself. And I think the best way of doing that is by carving out your own little niche or in an area that or a style that interests you. And for me, that was, I guess, combining my understanding of landscape architecture and design with comedy itself. And I could find a place where I would be able to do what I wanted and control, I guess, my own trajectory without having to rely on, you know, if a particular booker liked me or if I, you know, if a particular club I wanted to work with me as well. So in doing that, I was sort of able to control it, and it ultimately ended up in me doing a show called Urban Jungle after doing like a bunch of, it was also weird in that it opened up a bunch of different corporate gigs for like landscape architects and architects, which are a little bit fun, but maybe a little bit like the 21st in that you've got this one subject or this one theme, those 21st parties I was talking at rather, this one subject or this one theme that you can build a whole set around, and it kind of is a little bit fun. But it ultimately culminated in me doing this show, Urban Jungle, which again is about architecture and design and a comedic take on it, which also I guess has its own limitations. Like I probably didn't realize that at the time, but there's only probably a certain number of people that are willing to come out and see that show, and it's probably something that you only see once before it's dead, which I guess is like, I mean, all sort of comedy specials or comedy shows, but you are working to a much smaller audience, which means also as well that you don't probably get a chance to refine it as much. So there's some limitations there, but I mean, that's the sort of direction I progressed in. And I don't think without doing that, I wouldn't have landed the job that I had now, because that was sort of a big part of me getting this, you know, switching to working as a writer and in radio, was showing that I had the chops as a landscape architect and an urban designer. So I knew what they were writing about, but also showing that I had the skill set to communicate and talk about it, you know, and present on radio and speak about urban design and maybe working it through a few quips while I'm talking. So that's been, is that a good enough answer my trajectory? That was kind of a little bit convoluted, but I guess what I was saying was I realized very quickly that if I was going to be happy doing stand-up, I had to be able to control my own narrative somehow, and I think I did rely very early on the approval of certain bookers, you know, wanting to book me for a gig, and I think that ultimately made me a little bit unhappy because I was so stressed about who was going to book me. So I figured if I can control that myself, I'll certainly be a lot happier.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, Nick, because a lot of times you know, obviously Nicole and I've running a few different rooms, but a lot of times, you know, people might fly under the radar. It's not that you don't want to book them, but they're too scared to approach you. And I now say to people, you know what, put yourself out there, reach out, because sometimes it's, you know, the opportunity is just there. It's just waiting for you just to reach out. And, you know, and it might not be this time, but it'll be next time. So yeah, I think it is important to have a bit of faith in yourself and confidence and just ask, you know, it's very rare that you'll say no, or it will be not on this one, but coming up, we'll keep you in mind. So
I think that's the thing maybe that I've struggled with the most, and you've probably pulled it out there. It's that I've sort of always struggled with my confidence in a weird way. I never think I am that funny, and I know I'm probably not alone in that. I know a lot of comedians struggle with that sort of confidence thing, but it's maybe the level that you let it affect you to. And maybe I think personally it's something that I really want to work on, in that actually genuinely believing I am funny, because I've got the track record to maybe prove that I am, at least locally within WA. I've got the track record.
Absolutely.
Or at least within one little very niche room called The Craft in Northbridge, I've got the track record to prove that I am. So it's like actually believing that. And that's, something that I've sort of always struggled with, and something I probably need to address.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about The Craft. So you and Grant created that room, and that was a great little room. That was like my favourite little end of fringe, you know, hangout little spot. So
yeah, it's
very welcoming, and yeah, it was a great spot. It did a very good room there.
It is funny, that sort of space. So I think we took it on, we did our first, Grant Machette and I, is another WA comedian who I'm, well, Scottish born but WA based comedian, who I'm sure you'll interview at some stage, but
yeah, we're talking.
You're talking, okay. He and I sort of he's probably my best mate in the Perth comedy scene, and we decided to do a split show together a couple of years ago, maybe 2018. Did a split show together at Fringe, and we were sort of looking for a venue, and again wanting, I think there's an element of wanting to be able to control that. So we were looking for our own venue where we could sort of manage things, and basically put in touch with the guys at the Craft, who had this sort of beer garden outside, this little alleyway that they converted into a beer garden, and we were basically able to close off the contrary to any sort of fire codes or building codes, close off the back end of that alleyway and cram about 100 people in, and it just made for this crazy intimate kind of weird comedy experience. But it's one of those ones where it was perfectly shaped for a comedy room. I mean, it did have a high ceiling, which maybe you don't necessarily want, but you probably need it in Perth in summer. But it was like narrow and cramped, and the laughter would just sort of bounce off the walls. It was this amazing sort of space.
I'm laughing because the way you're describing it, do you know what I've always called it is the airplane room. It's like going into an aircraft. You know, you've got 100 seats on one side and 3 on the other, and you walk down that aisle.
100%. And it's one of those ones where, I mean, I'll be honest, we've had plenty of complaints over the years of like, and these are my friends coming to me as well, just being like, mate, it is so sweaty in there. It's unbearable.
Really?
You know, your thigh might be pressed up against someone else's thigh, and it's quite an intimate space, but when it's rocking, it's absolutely rocking.
Nick, I've had that problem, and I'm sure you haven't. It pays to be little, hey?
Yeah, no, 100%. Or on stage, I'll be honest. I've not actually ever sat in it, so I have no intention of sitting in it and sort of developing that empathy. But you know, and it is funny. It's sort of just, I think, maybe by the nature of the setup. So there's like there's a couple of rooms, a couple of tables, sort of behind the room itself, where a lot of comedians would just sort of come and hang out. And it sort of became this unofficial hangout for comics. And I'm a little bit sad. Obviously, I'm not getting back there this year, because of for Fringe this year because of the lockdowns. You know, if I wanted to come back, I'd have to pay for a 2-week quarantine myself, and then, you know, potentially only spend a couple of weeks. It just didn't seem worthwhile. So so Mush is running that himself this year, but basically what it did, so we did that sort of first show, and I think that we, like, I'll put it in air quotes, sort of let some other people do their shows there in that first year in 2018, and we sort of became close with Ray, who runs the place, and Sasha, who's also a manager there, and we sort of realized that this space had real potential to actually host a bunch of gigs. So I think it must have been 2019 was our first year of actually managing a full program of shows at the Fringe. So we did that and just sort of packed it out. You know, weekends particularly it would be absolutely rocking, and then we did the same thing earlier this year, and then Mush is going to continue that again next year, 2021.
That's awesome. No, it was lots of fun. I think you guys were very welcoming to Nicole and I very early in the scene, so thank you for that. It was always good to drop in on you guys, and you're like, just come in, have a look.
Yeah, no worries. I mean, cool. I think it's one of those ones, and you sort of mentioned it there. I went from, particularly with that space, we also ran sort of an open mic night outside of Fringe for a little while, and I think you kind of do realize that the people, you know, booking gigs, especially if it's an open mic, are just bloody looking for people to fill spots, and they could not care less. And I think that also changed your mindset, switching from being the comedian to being the booker. You know, it's a huge shift.
Yeah. I know. Nicole and I've only just started doing an open mic room. It is a bit of shift, isn't it? So yeah. And that's, we're a bit strict, I think, but not really. We've got rules, but yeah, I don't know. That sounds bad. But anyway, I can't.
No, that's fine.
Yeah. But we've only got, like, I think 6 spots a month in the open mic section. So, and that's at the Charles Hotel. So yeah. So we've relaunched the Charles Hotel. Nicole has a good relationship with Chris. So that's all happening. And
oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Gee, six spots. That's got to be competitive.
Well, then we go into like a semi, you know, well, the pro sort of area. So tonight, I shouldn't say that because it won't air tonight. yeah.
But there's a show at some stage.
There's a show. Yeah. So, okay, sorry, I'll ask you another question. Sorry.
Is this okay as well? Am I talking enough? Too much?
No, you're good. Fine. You're very good. Cool. All right. Sorry. What was your most memorable moment as a comedian then?
Jeez. Most memorable moment. That's a tough one. And maybe this is kind of maybe sad. I don't know. I don't know if I've particularly got a sort of like standout moments. I think maybe that there's a little bit of me that's never happy with what I've done. I find it very difficult to be satisfied with what I put out there. I think maybe, you know, and again, it's probably, I'm sure a lot of people are like this, but I'm constantly looking to improve it. I find it very difficult to sit and sort of celebrate a moment. I think mentally I'm constantly like, oh, I could have done this better. I could have done that better. You know, I will come off stage and just be like, smash that. That was absolutely brilliant. That still does happen. And probably if you ask Marsh, probably do it too much. but there's always something, that I'm not happy with. So I don't know if there's like a big shining moment. There's probably just like sort of gigs that, that have been kind of fun. And usually it's someone important to me being at that gig. And then doing particularly well out there. They're probably the moments. Like I remember my girlfriend's parents, they'd sort of always seen me do stand up, you know, in their American, and I'd do sets in these shocking places in America because I'd obviously didn't know anyone. So I'd be in these open mic rooms and the audience would be mostly comedians and they would just be, they were so dire. So they'd sort of only seen me do comedy in these environments. And they came to Perth Fringe 2019 where I did my first Urban Jungle show and also did my first, oh, not my first, sorry, I was also doing a split show with Marsh. And they were on weekends, they would double up. So I would, they came and they did basically back-to-back shows with me and I crushed both of them. And it was... that was incredibly satisfying. I'm trying to think who else have been happy to have seen me do it. I mean, I've also once here in the UK, one of my bosses just inadvertently happened to be at a gig that I was on, the lineup it was bad. It was a open mic night, and it was just really poorly run. If I'm perfectly honest, like there was no one. You know, people were doing 7 minutes with no laughs, 10 minutes with no laughs. There was like no one doing the light, even though you only meant to have a 5 minute spot. And I mean, it was probably a little bit unfair of me to even be there with a lot of these people that were starting out. But it was just the worst. I think it's the worst comedy night I've ever been to. There was a massive crowd, and the show was just shit. And I'd sort of been watching this for like an hour, you know, and the MC couldn't even rein in this guy that was just talking and heckling throughout it. And I basically got up on when I was eventually on. I basically acted as if I was the MC and just like pulled the room into line. You know, just this guy tried to talk. I absolutely shredded him. The crowd was on my side, just sort of cheering. It felt as if they were going to like carry me off stage, and I just absolutely crushed it. And that was incredibly satisfying. But then interestingly, I did go back and listen to that gig. I didn't even do that well. I think it was just the context of the, you know, the where that was taking place and what had been happening throughout that night. Set that up to be quite like a memorable gig, and that was kind of funny as well, because then he's also coming back to work and telling everyone how great I was, and it's like one of those ones where it's like, oh, that's kind of nice. But I mean, equally, I could probably pick out, you know, 10 shows that I couldn't stand or that something went wrong at. So it's one of those ones where I am there's not a shining moment. There are just sort of sets that are particularly fun, but equally and probably outweighs it even more. There's plenty more that I'm unhappy with or things that I want to do better. Yeah. And I think that's something I would like to work on. I would like to sort of celebrate whatever I'm doing. Like I sort of did a tour earlier this year of urban jungle across the east coast of Australia, and I don't think I was ever truly satisfied with it. But I think, you know, what I managed to put together is something that should be celebrated, even if it's not perfect. So that's more me saying that for me, that's something that I probably need to work on.
Yeah, definitely. Because that's such an accomplishment, doing that, being able to tour is something. So, yeah, but I do get it. I often have massive imposter syndrome and self-doubt. So it sounds like, you know, you're overloading, overthinking as well. So I empathize with you. It's a hard thing to get your head around, isn't it?
Yeah. I think yeah, there is that. I think imposter syndrome is exactly what it is, and I think I feel that. I don't think I'm special, and I mean, I could give you the sob story. I think a lot of comedians have this, but I think it's just learning how to deal with it, and it's probably something that I haven't properly addressed, and something that I would personally like to work on. But I think there is that thing, and I think we sort of joked about it at the start. There's like an element of progress versus perfection, and I think I'm always looking for perfection, but I've got to be okay with just making progress. And I think that's important.
Yeah, I think baby steps. You know, you can't just step up, like if you're stepping up a step ladder, you can't just go from the bottom straight to the top. You've got to progress through each rung. So, yeah, keep going. You're doing great. We loved working with you. So
this is what I needed. I should just call you up whenever I'm having these sorts of doubts.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, message.
I think maybe that's something I do have to do. It is, yeah, just to sort of go back and celebrate. Because like I said, it was a sold out shows on the East Coast in a market where people didn't know me at all. Can I jump back? Can I tell you the worst shows I've ever done? And I think this is where I sort of realized that I have no profile really in Perth, really no profile anywhere else. Like Marsh and I, we had a sold out run at Perth Fringe in 2018, and actually I shouldn't say no profile. We'd both been pretty prolific on the Perth scene for a couple of years, so I think people did know us, and it wasn't just my mum and her friends showing up. Like they were, you know, we probably put on maybe 14 shows, 100 people in each night. Like it was a genuinely completely sold out run. It was insane. So we probably had about 1400 people come and see us across Fringe. You know, and maybe I knew about 150 of them, and Mush has no one here in Perth. So there's still like, you know, 1200, you know, people that we don't know coming to our shows. And then Mush and I went to Adelaide Fringe, you know, and we're in this shitty venue that was away from the hub with absolutely no profile and no one knowing who we were. And I think we did four shows and maybe sold 10 tickets. Yeah, it was grim. That was soul crushing. And yeah, probably tested our friendship a little bit. I got a little bit sensitive because there was one night where I did appallingly and Mush actually did quite well to like a room of four people or something like that. You know, and he built that set off basically tearing my set apart, which for the audience was absolutely hilarious. But for me, I was quite sensitive. But he's sensational bloke. He sort of consoled me and then apologized, even though he definitely didn't need to. And then I guess a couple of days later, I was able to actually be like, yeah, sorry, I was a little bit out of line. I think it's one of those ones where it's like you've got to, in those sorts of environments, it's just about putting on a good show and just about being entertaining. And that's what he did and what I certainly had not done. So he was perfectly justified in tearing me a new one. But then equally, one of those shows as well was sensational. I think I did it to three 19-year-old blokes and I basically broke down my set. And it's one of the, I think, one of, again, probably if I listened back, it was appalling, but I didn't record it, so I don't know. So it's one of those ones that's just in my head. And I had this amazing set to sort of three people and did something really meta and broke down my jokes and their minds were blowing. But, yeah, I don't really know why I wanted to get onto that. I think it was just Adelaide Fringe.
That's just incredible, Nick, like to go from such a high and then.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I can see why that would have been hard to cope with. So. Yeah, I was going to ask you, what's a challenge that you faced for which you're grateful for?
Look, I mean, without wanting to be too cliche, and it's probably, you know, that whole one where it's like I wouldn't change anything. But actually, more than anything, is probably what I need to change is actually learning from them. Because I think I have these realizations over and over again that I'm doing or making the same mistake and probably not fixing it. Sorry, I stopped playing with my microphone. Probably not fixing it. So if there's a particular challenge I'm grateful for. I mean, if I were to go back, it would be looking at that show I did on that run of shows I did on the East Coast last year. You know, to try and sell tickets to a show when nobody really knows, well, nobody knows who you are, was incredibly difficult. And it was just like everything from actual marketing to managing the show, and I certainly didn't do any of it perfectly. You know, to even recording the show, I ended up, it was just going to be me basically on my own doing everything. You know, lucky I was in a position to basically, this sounds pathetic as a, what I was, 26 year old bloke at the time, to basically ask my dad to come on tour with me just to help me. But that was, you know, having someone as an offsider, basically, you know, him doing the doors, but it was just the two of us sort of doing everything. And that was incredibly difficult. As simple as it sounds, to just sort of, all I really had to do was stand up on stage with a microphone. But to put that all together, there is so much that goes behind it. And even though I had put on shows in Perth, it was sort of made easier by the fact that it was in Perth and I had a network around me, and it was much simpler. But being on the road like that, working with people I didn't really know, at venues that I didn't really know, trying to market to an audience of people that I don't know, was incredibly challenging. And I probably do need to unpack that a little bit further. I mean, I've been pushing that away. I think that was in February I did that. So you know, 9 months, you, 10 months.
You but, said a second ago that, you know, pathetic because you're 26 and ask your dad. I see that as such a beautiful relationship with your father, and well done for being able to travel with him, because it's, you go through adulthood, but what a beautiful bonding time for you guys.
Yeah, it's, I realize I got my age wrong at 27. it's one of those ones where it was, you know, and I'm lucky that, you know, he's not, he wouldn't say semi-retired, but he has a little bit more time on his hands. He only works 4 days a week. So he just had to take a couple of days off. So yeah, we had that really, really, yeah, it was really, really nice, but also really, really testing, I think for me. But it was amazing that I had him to sort of support me and do that with me.
Yeah, no, I think it's nice if you can sit in a space with your parents as an adult. So yeah, well done.
It's one of those funny ones where it's like you spend, I don't think I ever particularly had this, I've always had a good relationship with my parents, but like, you know, you probably spend a few years just rolling your eyes at them and being like, oh, they're an absolute pain in the butt. And don't get me wrong, I still do that. Still in my head. But I think there's that moment where you recognize it. And for me, it happened probably in my very early 20s, maybe 2021. I realized that they were actually people and they do have a life and they actually are interesting. And wow, they've actually done some things that are kind of cool and I can learn from them. I don't know, I'm incredibly lucky to have that sort of relationship with my parents, because I know not everyone sort of has that. But, you know, ultimately your parents are people, and if you recognize that they have a life beyond you, it's when you have that realization, it's kind of nice. So I'm lucky. I'm quite close with both of them, and they're both decent people, so it's good. And I probably tear into them both on stage a fair bit, so it's nice. nice that they're still willing to put up with me.
They've got you back, that's for sure. Yeah. Yeah. What's some of your pet peeves?
Pet peeves. I'm a little bit of a, is this stand-up pet peeves or just general?
It could be. You can give me gossip.
God, at the moment, people are doing my head in with not wearing a mask. I mean, no, London's pretty good, but for me, it's like, it's just like a courtesy thing. Like, I don't think, sorry, I'm just going to get a ramble here. Like, look, I don't want to wear one. I don't really care, but if it's a little bit like, you know, when you're in primary school or whatever, and you're being held in for detention as a class, and yet there's still one kid mucking up and continually holding you back by just not, it's just like, look, we don't want to be here. We're not enjoying this. We don't want to be here either. But if we just bloody do what they say, there's a chance that they'll let us all free in, you know, sooner. And that's how that feels a little bit for me. It's like, by not wearing a mask, just bloody follow the rules. And there's a chance, I'm not saying that it's definitely going to happen, but there's a chance that this will all end sooner if we just do what they're saying. So yeah. that's just my pet peeve at the moment. Just bloody wear your mask when you're on public transport in London. Okay. pet peeves. I don't know if I particularly have any in relation to stand up. There's certainly things that annoy me, right? Because I haven't given them much thought. Just the masks at the moment. That's the thing that does my head in. I think maybe there's an element of I was trying to think of that. What am I trying to word here? Maybe there's an element of because I also saw it when I was running a room. There can be an element of people just booking their mates, which I completely understand. But I don't know if that's a pet peeve, because I think it's just you end up booking who you trust because you want to put on a good show. I think I'm pretty fine on that front.
So Nick, in terms of masks, because Perth hasn't had to wear masks. Touch wood, we've been lucky. Do you guys get fined if you don't wear a mask?
I think we can, but nobody's enforcing it. I think that's the thing. It doesn't get enforced. There are rules, but I mean, I think the other thing is, it's like, you know, if you are the person that's meant to be enforcing it, so not a police officer, but if you're like a bus driver or a supermarket vendor, and someone doesn't want to wear a mask, there have been instances of people like getting quite violent about not wearing a mask. And I think asking someone to wear a mask might be deemed as risky, so they're not doing it, which I understand where they're coming from. I'm a big candy ass, so I wouldn't be asking scary looking people to put on masks either. But I think it's basically not enforced, which is a little bit frustrating. But again, I don't know how they do that. I'm assuming that the Met, stretched as it is, so stationing people to, stationing officers to make people wear masks, particularly in 2020, I don't think would go down too well.
No, probably not. If you were a character in a book or a TV show, who would it be and why?
Jeez. Character in a book or TV show. Is it weird that I was going to say Harry Potter? I don't know why. definitely, that's not Harry that Potter's is not cool, my. Yeah, it is cool. I mean, let's not go with that as my answer. I think my thing is the TV and the books I read are not. They're all sort of real life with flawed protagonists, and I think I'm flawed enough as it is that I don't need to switch mine for someone else's. At least I'm like comfortable with mine and I know where I'm at. I mean, that being said, I've watched plenty of brilliant TV this year. So maybe it's like, which world would I want to inhabit if I can reframe it like that?
That's probably,
which world would I want to dive into? I'm sure in reality it was absolutely horrible, but I started watching Mad Men this year, and there's just something about the simplicity of the 50s and 60s that is kind of appealing. And obviously as any sort of millennial would be, I'm completely into mid-century design. So mid-century sort of modern, and that features throughout that show. So maybe I'd go back to I'd find myself in Mad Men. I think that'd be a nice one.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one, but yeah, the retro sort of dress sounds good. So
nicely tailored suits. A lot of scotch at lunchtime sort of thing, which I can definitely get around.
Doesn't sound too bad.
No, it's all right. Yeah, it seems all right. I'm sure in reality it was like sweaty and smelly, because I don't think they'd invented deodorant properly yet. And I'm sure it was actually gross, but watching it through a screen, it does seem appealing. So I'd dive in.
No, that's funny. Okay. So what about, what's a ridiculous way that someone's tricked you, or have you ever
ridiculous
been
tricked? Someone's tricked me.
I ask it because I'm really gullible and I believe everything.
I think if I've been Sorry, that's a good question. I mean, I think maybe it's like being, if we want to frame it around comedy, I think it's being tricked or convinced that a particular gig is make or break. That'd be my one thing, and I don't think that's ever the case.
Yeah,
maybe it is. Maybe if you pick something up high profile enough, but for me, I seem to care and think some gigs are going to be particularly important, and then in reality, you realize that it didn't really matter, and it never sort of really matters, which is kind of refreshing. I think that's one thing I've always sort of, maybe it's a dark outlook on life, but remembering that you know, we're all going to be dead in 100 years, so what does any of this even matter? Anyway, that was kind of dark.
Less for me, so that's all right. Hey Nick, what about phobias? Do you have any?
None really. I'm not really, weirded out by that much stuff. I mean, I think I'm maybe a phobia is like the quiet. I can't handle the quiet. I'm always working or doing something. So I think I very much struggle to switch off, and I think probably some of that is just being alone with my thoughts. So there you go. Can't handle the quiet. Maybe that's my phobia.
Wow. One of mine is spiders. Last night we had a situation at home. I'm so pathetic that my 14-year-old son said, "Mum, you are the adult here." And I argued that he's taller. So he had to deal with it. It was bad. I'm really bad with spiders. I actually, can't handle them.
No, okay, I give you that. Maybe my two ones I am scared of snakes, and I am scared of sharks. Like I used to surf quite regularly with a few mates, but the whole time I was out there, I just have in my head, my brain would just be going dun dun, and it's like this isn't even enjoyable. I realized very quickly that I didn't even like surfing. I just liked getting a coffee with them afterwards. So I just sort of eventually cut out the surfing and would just meet people for coffee, and that's
just looked after their gear, right?
Yeah, that's me on the sand.
Oh no! How good is Jaws? It programmed us to fear sharks just beautifully.
Phenomenal as well. That it's just, and I'm not trying to claim this. I think I watched a movie called The Holiday the other day with Jack Black, and they literally talk about the Jaws theme song, and the magic of it is that it is just two notes. Dun-dun. Phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal that you can create a villain with two notes.
We universally know the song. It's amazing. Just like Coke, right? Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
Branding's amazing.
Netflix as well. It's just those two or three notes at the start, and that's all you need. Two notes. It's phenomenal. And you're like, right, I'm set. This is going to be brilliant. Maybe I need that. Maybe I need something to follow me around. Just play two notes so that people. I need to up my branding, perhaps.
It might work. You never know. Nick, have you got any jokes that you could share that are either yours or someone else's, as long as you credit them?
Now, you flagged this with me early, and I'm going to be honest. The last time I told a joke, not in a stand-up setting, it went appallingly. Not in a stand-up setting. The last time I told a joke like this over a podcast, it was absolutely shocking. So I think I'm personally a little bit scarred from that experience, and I realize that a lot of what I do does rely on in person. But I'll tell you that one. I had three architects sat around for a round table, and actually, funnily enough, which is why I thought it was appropriate to do it, sitting down for a round table to talk about building humor into design. Thrilling topic, I'm sure, for most of your listeners. But do check it out on monocle.com/radio/ondesign. But basically, I was sitting down to have that discussion. I thought it would be quite amusing to work a joke. And I can't even remember what I was. I wish I could remember the joke that I tried to tell, because I actually now want to have another crack at it. Basically, I told her and it just landed completely flat. And someone literally asked, was that the punchline? And I was like, yes, it was. That has absolutely worked and absolutely fired on urban jungle on shows on the East Coast. So you can pack it up and buzz off. But No, so I think I'd rather people come and pay or just look me up online, yeah, because I you think can find a few videos and I'm an absolute machine when I want to be.
No, that's fair enough. Where can people find you? I know you just did your podcast. Where else can they find you?
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing I probably need to work on. I get sapped by social energy, social media very easily. I mean, you saw that firsthand. I basically didn't reply to you for a week. And that's not you. That's just me. I find keeping up with social media incredibly difficult. But you can find me. I think I'm Nick Monise, just NicMonisse on basically every platform. So actually definitely on every platform except TikTok.
I recall when I first met you, you didn't even have Facebook, so you know.
Yeah, I've never been a fan of it. I think I just find it very, very draining. It just saps energy out of me. So yeah, you can now find me on everything. I might take a few weeks to reply to you, but yeah, seek me out or just like my stuff when I do post it.
Quarterly. Yeah, people can just like that. That's okay. All right, Nick, thank you so much for joining us today. It's just been great to have a chat to you in London. I can't believe you're over there. And yeah, thank you for taking the time to have this moment. And thanks to everyone for listening in. You're listening to Yvonne Fletcher on Bounce Back, and we've had Nick Monise. Thanks, Nick.
Thanks, Yvonne.
Bye.
Bye.